So thank you very much. So thank you all for arriving this morning. So I want to talk about neural tube development. But before I do that, let me just say a couple of things. So first of all, in case I don't get to the end, let me acknowledge the people in the lab. So there's this sort of a current list of people in the lab. And I've also tried to put citations on slides as we go through. And the work I'm going to talk about today, the external collaborators mainly include Anna Kacheva, Karen Page, and Peter Solich, and thank you to the funders. And I also wanted to mention, before we get going, development. So as editor-in-chief in development, with my fellow editors here, Tom Alacqui and Cassandra, who hasn't arrived yet. I'm sure they would join me in saying that we're very keen to see more papers from this field in the journal. As you know, development is the premier journal for developmental biology. And not only is it the premier journal, it's also a not-for-profit charity. And we put more than $1 million a year back into the community. So by publishing your paper in development, not only will you earn the admiration and respect of your colleagues, but you'll also be supporting your community. But we can only publish papers that you submit to us, unfortunately. So please do send us your paper. Okay, so, I've been thinking about it. So as a developmental biologist, I mean, what I want to understand is how do you make the right cells in the right place at the right time in the right numbers in a developing tissue? This question is important whether you're interested in laying down the basic of an organism, organizing the digits on the end of your limbs, or putting the right neurons in the right place in the central nervous system. And part of the interest in this question is because function follows form. For a functional tissue, you need to have the right cells in the right place. So how does a cell know where it is in a developing tissue, and how does it use that information to adopt the right identity? And if we think about those questions, that leads on to what I call the six P's of developmental biology. So what we'd like to understand is position. So how do cells know their location, pattern? How do they use that information to adopt the right cell identity? How do they make those decisions? Proportion. So how is growth controlled and coordinated? Precision. How reliable and accurate is pattern, and how is that accuracy achieved? Pace, what controls the tempo of developmental processes. And finally, purpose, what actually determines cell function? What's the underlying basis of individual cell function? And if we think about those six P's, what we'd like to get is an answer of two P's, right? So performance, so the mechanism, but also can we derive some general principles here? So if we think about sort of mechanism and principles, one idea that comes up repeatedly, and we discussed this yesterday, is the idea of morphogens. Now, I don't want to get into another economical or sectarian discussion about the exact definition of a morphogen. What I would emphasize for me, I think the important features, the important criteria, is this idea that cells have to receive some information, external information, so in some way it gives long-range information to individual cells, and they use that information to adopt a particular cell identity. And if you want sort of a more than that five-word description, can I recommend a review I wrote with Andreas Sagner a couple of years ago, which gives you sort of a 10,000-word version of that paragraph. So if we think about the idea of patterning of morphogens from this perspective, what I really want to focus on is how cells are receiving and interpreting that information. So really think about this from the perspective of a cell within the tissue. And if we think about it in this way, we can think about it as an information processing problem. So there's some external information, so some signal information being received by the cell, so what form does that information arrive in? And the cell uses that information, processes that information to generate a particular cell identity. And sort of the underlying hypothesis of the work that we do in the lab is the hypothesis that the information processing mechanism is the gene regulatory network controlled by the morphogen. And that's what I want to talk about today. And I want to talk about it in the context of the developing neural tube.
Sorry, where would you see cell-cell communication in here? Do you class that as an external input?
Yeah. So this will be some input from external to the cell.
If it's like direct next door to the cells.
Still an external input, right? So I really want to think about it from that perspective of if you're sitting in the nucleus of a cell, so what are you responding to?
So here you're suggesting, or actually stating, that the processing of the information is really hierarchically positioned downstream of the input, and there's no...
And we'll get back to the fact that there is feedback. Definitely I will come on to that.
Following the sort of...
Yeah.
Program,
absolutely. And we'll come back and discuss the fact there's feedback at every level of this. Yeah.
James, you said that you're focusing on the gene regulatory network as to control the input-output relation. Are you focusing on that only because you just want to, or you are saying actually that you believe that this is actually what controls the input-output relation? That there are no other things controlling the input-output relation.
I'm not sure what you're getting at. What else are you thinking of?
I'm just saying you could have also cellular processes actually that don't require gene expression actually that would control input-output response and have no...
So that would be going on internally in the cell, so that would be part of the...
Input-output response.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
So you're focusing more on...
So I would consider that part of the internal gene regulatory network of the cell. So let's just sort of give some biological context. I've been interested in the development of the vertebrate central nervous system, and in particular, spinal cord for many years. So the reason for this is that I think it's interesting. The spinal cord is very important to us. It's allowing me to stand up at the moment. But it's also it's an experimentally tractable region of the nervous system. The organization is simpler than other areas, other regions of the nervous system, but it's organized along similar principles. So functionally distinct neuronal subtypes are spatially segregated. So coming into the dorsal spinal cord, so dorsal is the skin of your back, so into the dorsal spinal cord is sensory information from the periphery, so touch, heat, pain, proprioception. And that information is processed by interneurons in the dorsal neural tube, and either sent up into the brain for further use or down into ventral regions of the nervous system where the motor neurons and interneurons that control motor output are located. So that organization of different neurons in different positions arises early in development with the spatially segregated generation of those neuronal subtypes. So to understand this problem, we need to go back into embryogenesis. And this arises very early in embryogenesis. So this is a cross-section through the forming spinal cord of a chick embryo about 2 days after the egg was laid. An equivalent time in mouse would be about 9 to 10 days after fertilization. In humans, this would be about 4 weeks after conception. So at these early stages of neural tube development, the majority of cells in the nervous system are proliferating progenitors. So here they're highlighted in green. And as those progenitors differentiate and become postmitotic neurons, they migrate in an apical to basal direction. So the first born neurons begin to accumulate along the basal surfaces, the lateral edges of the forming neural tube. So already at this stage, we can see molecular evidence of dorsal ventral pattern. So along this dorsal ventral axis, the progenitors are arrayed into domains which are molecularly distinct. And from those domains, distinct neuronal subtypes arise. So we just focus in the ventral neural tube, we can see six domains, molecularly distinct domains of progenitors, each of which generates a distinct neuronal subtype, so a bunch of distinct interneurons and motor neurons, and they have a characteristic position within the neural tube. So this problem of how you organize neuronal subtype identity becomes one of understanding how you organize pattern along this dorsal ventral axis.
Are the neurons that are born in different regions are different in their function or in the connectivity?
Both. So we can already, as soon as they're born, we can recognize molecular distinctions between these, some of which are functionally relevant, so neurotransmitter subtype. In addition, the position of the residence of cell bodies is characteristic, plus the connectivity of their axons and dendrites. And they have, most of these have beginning to be increasingly well-established physiological functions.
Something very stupid, but the progenitor pool remains while you keep differentiated cells throughout lifetime, or only...
So this progenitor pool changes in proportion and cell number over development. So if we focus on mouse, these progenitors will be... there from about E8.5 in mouse development. Neurogenesis ends at about E12, E13.5, at which time there are still some progenitors left, and they go on to produce the glial cells. So after 13.5, you predominantly generate oligodendrocytes and astrocytes in the spinal cord. And by birth in the spinal cord, any remaining progenitors, which are relatively few, become the ependymal layer, so the cells which line the central canal. And in the spinal cord, that's very few cells are left by birth. In the brain, there are more radial glial cells left at that time.
Presumably at birth, you have a certain size of neural tube,
yeah,
which reflects the the growth of,
yes,
neural differentiation,
yeah,
from progenitors. But then it's going to grow again during adulthood, I mean through lifetime. Is this due to other types?
So there's very little, if any, new neurogenesis in the spinal cord after mid-gestation. Growth can be axon growth, right? So the growth of dendrites, neurites, rather than actually new cells. And there is some gliogenesis throughout life. In response to injury, you can also reactivate, particularly gliogenesis in the spinal cord. Yeah.
So I better understand the morphology there. So these territories are disconnected, for example, the orange.
Okay, well, let's look at some real data. Is that helpful?
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is what it actually looks like. So if we look at, so now we're focusing on a region here in the spinal cord. And you can see here's a bunch of genes, and you can see that they're expressed in distinct spatial patterns of expression along the dorsal ventral axis. Yeah.
Could you just comment on the morphology of the cells in this tissue?
Yeah.
So we're looking at nuclei, right?
Yeah, so these are nuclei.
Pseudostratified?
This is a pseudostratified epithelium. So the apical surface of the epithelium is on the inside. So this starts out as a sheet,
yep,
which then folds up in the middle. All of these progenitors have apical contacts and basal contacts. And you can see it's actually a very dense and deep pseudostratified epithelium.
Is it known
and it's
how
also
that
characteristic
transition?
Along the dorsal ventral.
Is it known how that transition happens? How the cells are elongating, and
yes,
they're kind of adopting some interesting shapes.
They're very interesting shapes, but they're very convoluted shapes. So they're essentially like tennis balls on bungees, right?
Yeah.
So you've got the cell body with the nucleus in it, and then long cytoplasmic processes which should have apical and basal feet. And the nuclei actually undergo an interkinetic nuclear movement, correlated with the cell cycle. So during G1 and S phase, they tend to move basally, so S phase happens basally. Then G2, they more rapidly return to the apical surface and undergo mitosis strictly at the apical surface.
Is the basal position of the nucleus at all related to what fate the cells will become, or? Is the morphology random, essentially?
If I understand your question correctly, I think I'd say the morphology is random. So all of these cells will be undergoing this interkinetic nuclear movement. As a progenitor decides to differentiate, that cell body will continue its basal movement, leave the progenitor layer, so the ventricular zone. At that point, the apical contact will also be lost, and Kate's story has shown a nice evidence that that loss is by abscission, so you actually cut off your apical cell membrane. The cell body then will enter into the mantle layer and then reorientate its apical basal polarity, so the axon will become effectively the apical domain.
So I'm a little lost. Apical side is...
In the middle.
In the middle, and we're looking here at the section?
Yes.
Okay. And then there is the second layer in lobe there.
This here is...
And these are differentiated cells now?
And these are predominantly motor neurons, in fact.
Got there by...
So they came originally from here. Okay. They've differentiated. They're residing here, and you can see them starting to send... These are motor neurons, which are the neurons which send axons out of the spinal cord. Okay, so this is what it actually looks like. So in terms of thinking about progenitor identity, you can see by the combination of gene expression, we can identify distinct domains of progenitors arrayed along the dorsal ventral axis. And that this pattern of gene expression depends on signals emanating from the ventral and dorsal poles. I'm initially going to focus on hedgehog ventrally. We may get time to talk about BMP dorsally. So hedgehog is produced by the notochord, which underlies the neural tube, and then slightly later by a specialist group of cells at the ventral midline, the floor plate. In the absence of hedgehog, you lose this pattern of gene expression in the ventral neural tube.
Can you give us an idea of scales, length scales, time scales of
that? Yes, it will depend slightly on species. And the neural tube, and you'll see shortly, the neural tube grows from the early times. The dorsal ventral length of the neural tube is 100 microns, that order. It will grow during this process of pattern formation to about 500 microns, 300 to 500 microns. So, yeah, exactly. And the time scale, so in mouse and chick, we're talking about a 2 to 3 day period of time. Right, so the question becomes, how do we establish this pattern of gene expression? So we know hedgehog is important. And indeed, several lines of evidence says that hedgehog is functioning at long range to directly control this gene expression. Moreover, evidence now from several years suggests that it can act in a concentration-dependent manner. So here's one type of experiment that supports that idea. So from the early chick embryo, we can explant out a little region of the forming neural tube, so the neural plate, and we can culture that ex vivo in a little blob of collagen, and then expose it to concentrations of recombinant hedgehog. So if we just look at the cells in one of those explants, in the absence of hedgehog, the gene expression in those explants here, looking at PAX7, corresponds to what we'd expect for the dorsal half of the neural tube. If we add a moderate concentration of hedgehog, so 1 nanomolar hedgehog here, then instead of PAX7, we see the majority of cells express this red gene, OLIG2, which is characteristic of the middle of the ventral neural tube. A higher concentration of hedgehog, 4 nanomolar, results in the induction of this green gene, NKX22, which is situated ventral to the OLIG2 expressing progenitors, right next to the source of hedgehog. Sandra.
Do we have information about the real concentrations of hedgehog in that tissue?
No. So this is recombinant hedgehog, and there's some. The biochemistry of hedgehog production is complicated because it's dually lipidated. The recombinant version is modified because of that as lipidation. So the actual relationship between the endogenous concentrations and what we use in vitro is unknown. And so we think about this as biological activity rather than actual concentration.
So,
So these domains of expression, so are they established simultaneously?
Sorry, okay. Wait.
Would 0.5 nanomolar be neither PAX7 nor OLIC2 like the pattern suggests?
Yeah, it's actually, so 100 nanomolar you would get into this region here. Yeah. So between 50 and 100 nanomolar, you're, this is P1 and P0 domain. Yeah. Right, so this is a experiment done at one particular time point, so 24 hours after we've added recombinant hedgehog. So we can also do similar experiments, but look at different time points. So using that high concentration, 4 nanomolar, 24 hours, it induces the high response gene. But if we look at 12 hours, then the majority of cells in the X plants initially express the lower response gene, OLIG2, and then you see a transition to expressing NKX22, and you can capture a few cells that look like they're right in the middle of that transition. So if we count the number of nuclei expressing individual genes, we see an initial induction of OLIG2, which peaks and then declines, and it declines as you're seeing the induction of NKX22. Moreover, Boris.
And that time trace was at what concentration? Or?
This is 4 nanomolar, so this is that
that's
high.
Okay.
So that's what we call the high concentration. So we can see the same sequence of events if we look in vivo. So if we look in the ventral neural tube, we see initially the induction of the red gene, the OLIG2, and then transition to NKX22.
Sorry, and if it were 2 nanomolar, would it just take longer?
We'll come back to that idea as well. So, yes, broadly speaking. But also, and you'll get more of a mixture. You know, if you catch it just right, you'll get a mixture of cell types.
And these temporal effects in vitro are commensurate with the time it takes in vivo?
Yeah, yes, so exactly. So this sort of 24-hour period is similar to, you know, the first 24 hours. And indeed, we can extend this not to just these two, but if we look at markers in the ventral neural tube along the dorsal ventral axis, there's a good correspondence between if we have increasing concentrations, we get more ventral cell types. Similarly, if we increase the duration of the high concentration, we see increasingly ventralized cell types. So somehow the cells are responding to both the duration and the level, the concentration of signal. So one question that arises then is what's happening in vivo? So what are the cells actually feeling, responding to in the neural tube? And to get a sense of that, I just need to briefly introduce you to the signaling pathway. So not to get into too much detail, but there's a derepression mechanism to initiate hedgehog signaling. So in the absence of hedgehog ligand, the transmembrane protein patched represses another transmembrane protein smoothened. And the consequences of that is that intracellularly, the GLI transcriptional effectors are proteolytically processed to form a transcriptional repressor which blocks hedgehog target gene activation. In the presence of hedgehog, hedgehog binds to patched, which relieves repression of smoothened, and now smoothened blocks that proteolytic processing. So full-length GLI transcription effectors accumulate, and the full-length GLI proteins are able to activate transcription. So the consequences of signal transduction are to reduce repressor levels and increase activator levels. So we were interested in trying to look at the level of the transcriptional effector, so we've used a transcriptional reporter for GLI proteins. So this is a transcriptional reporter for hedgehog signaling. So if we look in transgenic mouse embryos with this reporter, we can see some kind of gradient within the ventral neural tube, so higher in cells most ventrally closest to the source of hedgehog, decreasing amounts in cells as we move away from the source of hedgehog. And we can now assay this over that developmental time window. So here's the sort of the 2 days we're talking about. And each of these lines represents a different position in the neural tube from 0% at the ventral midline to 100% at the dorsal midline. And if we look across this, we can see that at every position, we're seeing this adapting response to hedgehog. So initially, the levels of hedgehog signaling, the levels of glia activity increase and they peak relatively early, and then they decline over the next day or so. And the amplitude at which the maximum amplitude you reach depends on your position in the neural tube. So the more ventral you are, the higher the amplitude which is reached.
So at what point are these cell phases fixed? Because you showed us 24-hour data that would seem to be near the peak of this.
Exactly. So we'll come back. Can we come back to how they're fixed? Because that's also coming back to how the gene regulatory network functions. So there are complicating dynamics here. So the cells are receiving changing levels of glia activity, and they're using those changing levels to acquire appropriate gene expression patterns. So one question we can ask is, why do you see these complicated dynamics of signaling?
Excuse me, but so if you're a cell that begins to be, say, in the 15% position, you'll be moved away from the source as well.
Yeah. Exactly. So that's
it's not the fact that you're trying to control cells, right?
So exactly. So if we think about why there are those complicating dynamics, I think there are two main contributors to this. So one contribution is actually negative feedback within the signaling pathway itself. So the evidence is, so as I mentioned, patched is the receptor for hedgehog, but it's also a negative regulator of the pathway. And it also turns out to be a target of hedgehog signaling. So this gives you negative feedback. So as you respond to hedgehog, you increase your negative feedback, so we'll become desensitized to signal. And then, as Tomer indicated, the neural tube is also growing over this period of time. So if you think about your position over this period of time as a cell in the tissue, you will also be moved away from the source of hedgehog by tissue growth over this period.
With negative feedback, do you understand why it's not, it doesn't turn into a periodic temporal on-off-on type of
thing? So, I mean, that one could argue this is about the kinetics of this process, right? So it's slow enough that you don't seem to go through multiple rounds of this. And this is somewhat, this is an oversimplification. Other components of the pathway are also targets of signaling. So, for example, indirectly, you down-regulate the glia proteins themselves. So there's clearly, the signaling pathway is clearly affecting its own transmission.
So what is the timescale of this negative feedback with respect to the timescale of being moved away from the source?
So the signaling pathway is surprisingly slow, right? So remember that the way you activate the pathway is you stop forming a repressor and you have to wait for the transcriptional and translational accumulation of the activator. So in fact, when you treat cells with hedgehog, it takes 3 or 4 hours before you see any noticeable transcriptional response at all. So this is actually, compared to many signaling pathways, this is, a very laid-back kind of signal transduction. Yeah.
Does the signaling start after the neural tube folds completely, or?
It's depending on which AP level you're looking in the neural tube. It's starting as the neural tube is closing. So in some places that would be just before you are closed, and in other regions it will be where you're.
Back to the question of being moved away from the source.
Yeah.
Is it known whether the gradient, what's the shape of the gradient, whether it scales as it grows?
No, it doesn't scale, as far as we can tell. So we've done a little bit of measurement, and these are quite crude. They're with antibodies against the sonic protein, and we can fit the gradient over this time with an exponential with a single decay length. So we don't see any evidence for scaling. Okay, so we've come back to this question then. So I've showed you this complicated signal dynamics, but you get out a very characteristic gene expression pattern. So how does that work? So what I'm going to argue is that that's a consequence of the downstream gene regulatory network. So as well as being nice markers for dorsal ventral pattern, all of these genes are themselves transcription factors, and they're connected together in a transcriptional network. So some of the evidence for this comes from classic developmental genetics. So for example, if we look at the function of PAX6, so PAX6 is a transcription factor expressed in progenitors throughout most of the neural tube. Its ventral limit of expression corresponds to the dorsal limit of NKX22. If we look in a mouse mutant lacking PAX6, there's no PAX6 protein, and what you notice is a striking expansion of NKX22 expression. Now, there's no obvious change in signaling here, so that suggests that one role of PAX6 is to set the response, the limit of the response of NKX22 to hedgehog signaling. So in the absence of PAX6, NKX22 becomes more sensitive to signaling. So these type of experiments allow us to reconstruct a transcriptional network from those genetic experiments and also from gain-of-function experiments where there are selective regulatory interactions between pairs of these transcription factors. And you can see there's a lot of cross-repressive interactions going on here, and sort of those cross-repressive interactions, as you will see, are important for generating these switches in gene expression as a function of position. So one thing we can do then from these kind of larger networks is abstract out smaller circuits comprising fewer of those transcription factors and begin to study those in more detail. So I'm going to talk about this little circuit here, which comprises four transcription factors, two of which are controlled by hedgehog signaling. So the reason for looking at these four transcription factors is because they allow us to define two boundaries of gene expression at particular positions in the neural tube. So NKX22 and OLIG2 you've already been introduced to. So NKX22 is expressed very ventrally in the neural tube. Its dorsal limit of expression corresponds to the ventral limit of OLIG2 and PAX6. And the dorsal limit of OLIG2 corresponds to the ventral limit of this transcription factor, IRAQUR3. So the question we wanted to ask is, does this network explain this pattern of gene expression? And if so, how is it functioning? Yeah.
So as the neural tube first forms, does these fates are like imposed onto these cell layers?
Yes.
And as they move away during growth, is there a change according?
Yes, there is, and we'll come back to that in a minute. So you see a sequence of gene expression. So initially these cells express the red gene, OLIG2, and then turn on the NKX22 gene. So there's a sequence of events. And then, as you'll see, once you've established a particular cell identity, that is maintained relatively stably. Okay, so the way we approach this question, one of the ways we've approached this question is from a mathematical modeling perspective, thinking of this network as a dynamical system. So we can take this cartoon and turn it into a set of linked ordinary differential equations, which just represent these regulatory links mathematically. And I won't go through the details of this, but we published this several years ago. I would say that to parameterize this model, we used an optimization technique, approximate Bayesian computation, with the objective of this model describing the spatial patterns of gene expression we observed in the neural tube. So once parameterized, then we can start to explore the behavior of the system with the parameters we've optimized.
Can you give us a sense of the number of parameters, though?
Yeah,
it's huge.
It's 14 or 15 parameters, if I remember correctly. It is a lot of parameters, and yeah, that's always, and we'll come back, hopefully we'll have time to come back to that issue. And one of the nice things about so we used ABC's optimization, and that actually gives you back not just one set of parameters, but gives you parameter ranges and the joint distributions between parameters. So you can begin to say something about the relationships between parameters as well. So some of the parameters are more constrained than others, and there's some covariation. So, but there's not a lot of correlation between parameters in this model, in fact. Okay, so once we had sets of parameters, we can then start to simulate this model. So we can simulate across a signaling gradient, and we can get back our patterns of gene expression, which is what we asked to happen. So this at high levels of signals, so ventrally in the simulations, you get NKX22, then at moderate levels of signal, a stripe of OLIG2, and then PAC6 and IROCLAS3, where there's low or no signal input. In addition, if we replicate the mutants, so for example, removing the PAC6 equation, then we see an expansion of NKX22 to lower levels of signal and a reduction in OLIG2 and, of course, no PAC6. And as you remember, that's in fact what you're seeing in the mutant situation with OLIG2 should be in here. So this is all well and good, but this is what the optimization, this is what we optimized for. What was more striking is that what we observed is that any of the parameter sets that gave us back the appropriate spatial pattern of gene expression also gave us back the temporal sequence. So if we challenged the simulations with a level of signal that at long times, so at steady state, gave us a high response gene, NKX22, we always saw a transient OLIG2. So you always see a transient induction of OLIG2 prior to the induction of NKX22.
It looks like there you have an initial condition.
So this is dependent on initial conditions, which again we took from the neural tube. So initially, neural progenitor cells are expressing PAC6 and IROCLAS3. This is a multistable system, and it does depend on initial conditions. Okay, so that sort of sequence of gene expression, as you remember, is what we're seeing experimentally. So we see a transient expression of OLIG2 prior to NKX22. So if we put this together, then we can, what we would argue is that this gene regulatory network is explaining both the spatial and the temporal behavior of gene expression in the neural tube and reconciles those two features of concentration-dependent response and a duration-dependent response. So you can sort of think about this in this kind of cartoon of the phase portrait of this. So, you know, if you're a morphogen believer, you can just look on this axis and see that the high response gene requires more signal than the low response gene. If you're a morphogen skeptic, you can just look along this axis, and this indicates that you need a longer duration of signal for the NKX22 than for OLIG2. But what it also indicates that given these initial conditions, in order to get into the NKX22 state, you always traverse a transient in OLIG2. There's no way of getting to the NKX22 without transiently expressing OLIG2. And that's a consequence of the regulatory logic, the way that the transcriptional network is wired together. Yeah?
I mean, I recollect that your system is set up such that if you turn the sonic hedgehog, everything would collapse.
So can we, we're just coming to hysteresis in a second.
James, do the dynamics suggest anything about the mechanism by which hedgehog must be moved between cells in order to achieve this?
No, and I'm completely agnostic to that. So this is, we're not thinking about the spread of hedgehog at all. We're just, if a cell is receiving this amount of hedgehog, how is it responding?
Looking at the relationship of inhibition and it's everything is mutually inhibiting except for PAC6 and the OLIG2.
Yeah, okay, so what this cartoon doesn't show properly is that, what are the positive inputs into these? So there's a signal positive input, which is spatially and temporally vary in the simulations. There's also uniform positive inputs into each of the factors as well. So we think of that as a tissue-specific positive input. And So the SOX-B factors, so SOX1, 2, and 3 would be candidate transcription factors, which are spatially and temporally uniform in the neural tube and activate neural progenitor transcription factors. So you can think of a positive arrow onto each of those factors.
If I remember correctly, you've shown that you can make mutations in the pathway itself and get very different hedgehog levels and still maintain the pathway.
Next slide, right? So exactly. So if we think about this phase portrait, one thing you can think about is what it predicts is that we can vary levels of signal. And so, for example, you could transiently increase levels of signal to a very high level. But if that wasn't sustained for long enough, you still wouldn't get the high response gene NKX22. And we can actually do that experiment genetically. So this is, it's a little complex, but let me take you through the next couple of slides. So genetically, the way we can do this is by deleting one of the GLE factors, so GLE3. So GLE3 happens to be the main transcriptional repressor in the pathway. And what happens in a GLE3 mutant, if we look at the level of the remaining GLE activity, we can see, using that GLE reporter, we can see compared to wild-type animals in a GLE3 mutant, you have much higher levels of signal at these early time points, but that isn't sustained. And by sort of a day, 24 hours or so, you're returning back to what look like normal levels of signal. Moreover, in the GLE3 mutant, despite that transient high level of signal, then patterning looks normal. So if we compare NKX22 expression between wild type and GLE3 mutant, it looks normal. So one reason for why this increase in signaling is transient is because of that negative feedback. So if we look at patch one, the component of the negative feedback, comparing HETs, so controls, to GLE3 mutants, in the GLE3 mutant you see much more patched and both spatially and in absolute levels. So the higher levels of signaling are resulting in more negative feedback, and that results in the system coming back into the normal dynamics of signaling. So what I said is that the reason why those increased levels of signaling don't result in a change in pattern is because the gene regulatory network is buffering that transient increase in signal.
But if you look at your model,
yeah,
if you think about your sort of bifurcation diagram as a function of the hedgehog signaling, there's particular boundaries between the things. And if I mess with the signals, those boundaries shift.
At steady state, a bifurcation diagram is at steady state. So we're talking about the transient before steady state.
Right, but I mean, what you showed in your sort of concentration and time diagram is there's roughly some level of integrated signaling that corresponds to particular phase with boundaries between them. So you're,
But what's doing the integration is the gene regulatory network.
I understand that, yeah. But I still think that you haven't shown us an explicit simulation of putting the lead profiles that you measure in the lead 3 through the model.
Yeah, so I didn't, but we have done that, and you get... So you can put in those dynamics of GLE activity and achieve the spatial pattern of gene expression.
So it doesn't move the boundaries at all?
So compared to what?
Compared to wild type.
Right, no, because you need sufficient time to get NKX22 expression. So the time scale here in the gene regulatory network is set by the degradation rate of these transcription factors. So we have some measurements for that, and the degradation rates of these factors is of the order of 3 or 4 hours. And if we use those in the model, then the time to an NKX22 bifurcation is of the order of 12 hours, right? So 3 to 4.
The steady state of these two things is the same, and you're just briefly upregulating it.
That's right. So if you think, because the bifurcation diagram, remember, is at steady state, so it doesn't matter what the signal, signal can be doing all of these stuff in the transient, as long as you don't sustain it for long enough, you don't get to that bifurcation.
So you would argue if you could sustain hedgehog signaling, you would move the boundaries.
Yes, and that's the kind of in vitro experiments we do where we manipulate hedgehog signaling concentration.
And if you turn off the hedgehog,
that's the next set of experiments.
His question is about multistability, which is
right. Wait, let me get through this one, and then we'll get to that. So, okay, so I'm arguing that the lack of effect on pattern is because the network is suppressing the, is effectively giving you a temporal averaging or not allowing you to see that transient increase in signal. So the prediction then is if we simultaneously increase the signaling in the transient, the GLE3 mutant, and we perturb the network, then we should see an effect of this. So genetically, that's a GLE3 PAX6 double mutant. So, but this is complicated to get through. So remind you that NKX22 and ONIC2 have this pattern of gene expression. This is pretty much unchanged in a GLE3 mutant. I've already shown you a PAX6 mutant, and remember PAX6 affects the extent of NKX22 expression because it represses NKX22. However, in a PAX6 GLE3 mutant, we see an even more exaggerated expansion of NKX22. So despite the absence of GLE3 not affecting the wild-type pattern, absence of GLE3, so a transient increase in signaling, does affect patterning in the PAX6 mutant. And now, essentially, half of the neural tube is NKX22 progenitors. So that's consistent with this idea that the gene regulatory network is providing some robustness to transient fluctuations in signal. So let's get to this multi-stability question. So this comes back to this issue of these dynamics of signal. So the signal goes up, you adopt a certain identity, and it appears that you retain that identity even as the levels of signal are reducing. So how do you maintain those patterns of gene expression even as the signal reduces to low or non-existent levels? And this comes back to this idea that the system is multi-stable and is conferring some bistability or multi-stability to individual genes, some hysteresis. So we think about this just from the high response gene NKX22. So NKX22 requires high levels of signal to be induced, but once induced, you can sustain NKX22 with lower levels of signal, so you get bistability. And so you can intuit that from thinking about the initial conditions. So initially, you're expressing a bunch of repressors of NKX22, so to induce NKX22, you need a lot of signal. But once you've induced NKX22, it's repressing its repressors, so it's easier to maintain NKX22 with lower levels of signal. So this again predicts and this again motivates an experiment. It predicts that if we induce NKX22 and then reduce signal, we ought to be able to sustain NKX22. And so we can do that with the explant experiments. So here's the setup of the experiment. So we take those chick explants and expose them to high concentrations of hedgehog for 18 hours, and that induces NKX22 expression. If we maintain that high level of signal, we maintain NKX22. If at 18 hours we reduce the level of signal, and we're doing this by adding a sub-threshold level of a hedgehog signal inhibitor, reduce the level of signaling to about a third of the inducing level, we can still maintain NKX22 once we've induced it. However, if we use that level of signaling from time zero, we're largely unable to induce NKX22. So once we've induced NKX22, we can maintain it with lower levels of signal than is initially required to induce it. So that's consistent with that bistability. Now, in addition, so thinking about hysteresis for a little more detail, if we completely block signaling at this time point, then we lose NKX22. So you need some signal, but not the level of signal necessary to induce it. Moreover, when you lose NKX22, it also looks like you don't return back through the same path, so you don't transient induce OLIG2 and then go back to PAC6, it looks like you return directly to PAC6, which again would be consistent with a hysteresis loop.
If you calculate the equations that you showed in the beginning, the dynamical system that you had, and you make it steady state, and you look at the fixed points, do you see by accelerating?
Yes. There's actually some tri-stability depending on the parameterization, in fact.
Still bothered by the fact that it would seem to me in your model, the boundary issue, let's say I'm a cell that's OLIG2, and I'm right near the border of NKX2. So just a little bit more signaling should push me over the
border. This is part two. We'll get to that, hopefully, some aspect of that. Okay, so let me summarize. So what I've told you so far is, so I've introduced you to this transcriptional circuit. What I've argued is it explains both the temporal and spatial behavior of gene expression in the neural tube. And it also has some other useful features. So it gives you some robustness to transient fluctuations in signal, and it gives you some memory, some hysteresis, so you can maintain gene expression even as the neural tube is growing and signal levels are changing.
So one point is, so you don't have a continuous pattern, but you have segments of some size. Is that size dependent on the growth?
So it's a combination of both the gradient, the influence of hedgehog signaling along the dorsal ventral pattern, and then growth. And growth is a combination of proliferation minus differentiation. So as I said, when progenitors differentiate, they leave the progenitor domain. And different progenitor types differentiate at different rates, whereas the proliferation is spatially uniform in the neural tube, nearly spatially uniform.
Do you think that, so I understand that the network explains why you have binary either or expression due to the reciprocal inhibition, but the fact that you have a rather smooth spatial boundary could stem from the sort of the pseudo-epithelial organization of the cells, the packing, the fact that they don't look too much, whatever.
Yeah, I may not get to this, but I did want to, yes, we will get to that, in fact. But I did want to mention, because I think these pictures, sorry, it takes a long time, I shouldn't have done that. These images are slight. As a Drosophila biologist, I think they're not what you're used to looking at, because you're looking at the other orientation. So I just had an image of looking at the neural tube if you were a Drosophila wing disc person. So this is, so really looking at the precision of these boundaries. So if you look down on the neural tube, so you open up the neural tube and look down on the apical surface as if it's the wing disc, what you see is this. So this is ventral, this is dorsal. So what you see is, so these are reasonably sharp domains, but they're not perfectly sharp. And you can see, so I think this gives you sort of a better indication if you're used to looking at boundaries within an epithelium from the apical surface. Actually, these green things are clones, so you can see that, again, like the Drosophila wing disc, clones remain relatively coherent. Okay. So I wanted to come back to this idea. So I argued that the transcriptional network is very important. So is this a general principle? And I would argue that is the case. So if we think about the anterior-posterior patterning of the early Drosophila embryo via bicoid and caudal working through the gap genes, what many, and you've heard about some of this work the last few weeks, what many people have argued is exactly the same idea. These graded signals are functioning via a transcriptional network comprising lots of cross-repressive interactions to divide an epithelium, to divide a tissue into domains of gene expression, which then go on to develop into parts of the animal. So I think this general idea of morphogen interpretation via gene regulatory network is going to be a general principle. More than that, in fact, so when we look at the topology of regulatory the gene regulatory network, what falls out of both the network I was showing you and the gap gene network is this little motif here, which, as you can sort of sense, has sort of two conflicting features to it. So it's got a bistable switch in here, so a cross-suppressive interaction, but it's also got a series of a ring of repressive interactions, which looks very much like a repressor-later, which has the effect, because you're repressing a repressor, of being a positive feedback. So you've got a combination of bistability and that repressor-later type feedback. And we were sort of so enamored by this, we went on to sort of do some more sort of theoretical analysis about the behavior of this this motif. And what we could see from that analysis is it could have two distinct types of behavior. So one is that bistability, which I've just been showing you, where you have a switch-like behavior, and that's when this repression dominates the repressor later. The converse behavior, when the opposite is true, is that you get an oscillatory-like behavior. So this same topology can give you either a stable spatial pattern, a switch-like behavior, or an oscillatory behavior. And I think that may be, so the discussion we had yesterday about short germ band versus long germ band insects, and the ability of a single transcriptional motif to behave in those two ways, depending on the parameterization, so depending on the strength of interactions, may be relevant here. I should also say we've been so enamored by this motif that we've decided to give it a name. And because it has both a stable behavior and an oscillatory behavior, the obvious name for this motif, of course, is an ACD. Okay. So, all right. So I've talked about position and pattern. I want to talk a little bit about precision. I think this may come back to some of Aria's questions. And this was motivated by, again, an experimental observation. So we're looking at a wild-type mouse embryo versus a PAX6 mutant embryo. And what I've been emphasizing in the PAX6 mutant is this expansion in the domain of NKX2-2 expression. But what is also noticeable, just looking at these cross-sections, is that in addition to the change in pattern, there's also a change in the precision of gene expression. So now you can see in the PAX6 mutant, much more intermixing of cells, where you have sort of green and red cells, much more intermixed than in the wild-type situation. So we were interested in trying to understand why is the precision loss or decreased in the PAX6 mutant. And so we're perturbing the transcriptional network. So we hypothesized, we reasoned that one reason for this could be stochasticity in gene expression. So the natural small molecule number results in stochasticity of gene expression. So this means, as you're sort of familiar with, even at steady state, you fluctuate around some mean level of gene expression because of the randomness of transcription translation and degradation. And the effect of stochasticity, when we think about this in the context of a multi-stable system, is that noise itself can result in transitions between stable states. So if we think about this in the context of fluctuations near a bifurcation, near a change in the steady state, so just noise could drive that transition from one steady state to another steady state. In a deterministic system, you would never have this transition. Moreover, the probability of the transition, the noise-driven transition, depends on exactly how close you are to the bifurcation point. So the closer you are to a bifurcation point, the more likely you are to jump from one steady state to another steady state. So we're interested in asking, so could this, could stochasticity somehow explain that loss of precision in the PAX6 mutant? So to begin to address this, we took that deterministic model that I've been describing to you, that ODE model, and turned it into a stochastic differential equation model using the Langevin approximation. And so this involves introducing a noise term to the equations. And we've used our best efforts to parameterize that noise term. So now we have a stochastic differential equation. Parameters are all the same as the ODE, apart from this introduction of noise. And now we can begin to simulate and look at the effect of stochasticity. So in the wild type, you see the same pattern of gene expression, but of course the boundaries are not completely precise anymore because you've got some noise-driven, got some stochasticity, some noise-driven transitions. Now, if we use exactly the same model, but just delete the PAX6 equation, so copying, mimicking a PAX6 mutant, what you see is two things. So first of all, you recover this expansion of NKX22, which you saw in the deterministic model. But what was striking to us is that you also see a decrease in the precision of predicted gene expression. So the consequence of removing PAX6 is not only to, in the simulations, not only to increase the spatial extent of NKX22, but to decrease the precision of the NKX22 OLIG2 boundary. Yeah.
Are you introducing this in the transcription factors in the network, or also in Hedgehog?
And this is only into the transcription factor equation. So this is, so the noise term goes on the four differential equations we have there. So we're not thinking about, at this stage, we're not thinking about noise in the signal itself.
And do you have any sense of what, how large the fluctuations you expect to be in the expression versus in the input?
No, I think that's a good question. I mean, so I, actually one thing we're very interested in now is thinking about the relative contributions of noise in signal versus noise in the transcriptional network itself versus other source of fluctuations, inaccuracies in patterns such as growth. Yeah.
Is there any evidence for a cell sorting phenomenon kind of resolving the boundary like there is in chick, like there is in zebrafish?
So I would argue no. So zebrafish is, this is actually mouse, but
okay.
In amniotes, I would argue there's little, if any, evidence. And we can come back and discuss this because there's some more evidence coming up which would more strongly argue that. And I think the reason, so one important thing to say is that the cell biology of the zebrafish neural tube is different from amniotes. So as I mentioned in amniotes, so in chick and mouse, the neural tube starts off as an epithelial sheet which folds up. So it's always an epithelium. Whereas in zebrafish, it doesn't start off as an epithelium. It starts off more mesenchymal-like and then cavitates to form an epithelium, so generates the epithelium. And actually, the sorting that's been reported happens prior to it forming, or as it's forming an epithelium. So actually, the cell biology is different in fish. And I think that's a consequence of the fish just having to do everything much more rapidly than amniotes. Okay, so this looks, so just introducing that noise into this has an effect on precision. So why is this the case? So we wanted to think about this in the context of these noise-driven transitions between steady states. So we think about this in the context of gene expression space. So here, so in this this graphic, what we're showing is gene expression space. So PAX6 here, so from low to high PAX6. NKX22 here from low NKX22 to high NKX22, and OLIG2, low OLIG2 to high OLIG2. So this green dot here is the OLIG2 steady state, and this red dot here is the NKX22 steady state. So if the cells start off in the OLIG2 steady state, in a deterministic system, they would just stay there forever. But in a stochastic system, they're fluctuating around that steady state. And occasionally a fluctuation may result in a cell jumping from the OLIG2 steady state to an NKX22 steady state. And that fluctuation, that noise-driven transition, happens if a fluctuation hits this point here. So this point is the saddle point in the system. So if a fluctuation takes a cell to that saddle point, then they will transition, fall into the NKX22 steady state. So if we look at, so these are the simulations from the stochastic differential equation. So if we look at how those fluctuations around the OLIG2 steady state, how they look in gene expression space, what you can notice is that these fluctuations aren't isotropic. In fact, they're angled slightly away from the saddle point, and they're angled away from the saddle point specifically in the PAC 6 dimension. So in the PAC 6 meter, of course, you lose that dimension. And the consequence of that is that now the fluctuations are all angled directly towards the saddle point. So the same amplitude fluctuation is now more likely to hit the saddle point in a PAC 6 mutant than in the wild type. So it's the structure of the fluctuation. So the gene regulatory network is altering the structure of the fluctuations. And the consequence of that is it's making a noise-driven transition less likely.
I thought when I looked at your picture, I could have, what I discerned was sort of ectopic NKX 2.2 expression sort of too far up.
Yes.
And then I would have just asserted that because you've lost the PAC6 repression, which represses the NKX 2.2, you just have less repression and therefore a sloppy boundary.
Exactly, and we'll come back to this in the next slide. But yeah, so you've got two things going on here. So this expansion of NKX 2.2, but also it's not a precise expansion. You've got more cells up here.
And that's the absence of repression, which would kill.
Right, so it's absolute, but it's also, if you were deterministic, you would just have a new boundary. And in fact, this boundary is much less precise than in this situation. And the next set of experiments will emphasize that a little more.
So you're saying that the properties of the network is not so much to limit the amplitude of fluctuations, but to orient them in a particular way to prevent crossing?
That's what I'm arguing, exactly. Okay. All right. So, yeah, that's what I'm arguing, is that another role for this gene regulatory network is to structure the fluctuations in such a way that it makes noise-driven transitions less likely. But of course, this is, as Eric has pointed out, this is quite a brutal perturbation where we're completely removing one node of the network, one transcription factor. And we were interested in trying to examine more subtle mutations, and in particular, subtle perturbations. In particular, we started thinking about the edges of the network rather than nodes. And if you think about the edges, what those edges represent are the cis-regulatory interactions, so the transcription factors interacting with their target genes. And we got interested in one particular cis-regulatory element associated with the OLIG2 gene. So this lies 33 kb upstream of the OLIG2 gene, so it's accessible, and also ChIP-seq analysis indicates it binds many of the effectors that we've been discussing, so including NKX22, the bleed binding sites, and also this pan-neural transcription factor SOX2. Also, previous work from several labs have indicated that this regulatory element is sufficient to drive expression within the OLIG2 domain. So this looks like an OLIG2 regulatory element. So what we were interested in doing is deleting that regulatory element and then looking at the effect on pattern formation. So here we're comparing wild-type mice with littermates in which we've removed just this regulatory element, so 3 kb region, which is 30 kb away from the OLIG2 gene. So if we look at the effect on OLIG2 expression when we delete this enhancer, I think two things are immediately apparent. So first of all, the size of the OLIG2 domain is smaller, and in particular, we've lost the dorsal half of the OLIG2 domain. What was also apparent is that the precision of the OLIG2 NKX22 boundary has also decreased. So I think you may be able to see here, you've got more of a salt and pepper expansion of NKX22 into the OLIG2 domain. And in fact, you don't have to trust me on this, we've actually measured this by looking at the number of neighbors of your same or different identity. And indeed, in the mutant, you see less precision than in wild type. So deleting this enhancer has several effects. So it reduces the size of the OLIG2 domain, but it also affects the precision of the NKX22 OLIG2 boundary. So why is this the case? So again, we can turn back to the stochastic differential equation model and ask, does this give us any insight? So as I mentioned, the input into this regulatory element includes a number of components, and we can use the model to specifically reduce those inputs into the OLIG2 gene and then ask what are the effects in simulations. So if we do that, so you've already seen the wild type SDEs, and that gives you the domains of gene expression with some level of precision at the boundaries. And now if we simulate the enhancer mutant, we can see several effects. So first of all, you can see a reduction in the size of the OLIG2 domain, just as you saw in the mutant situation. There's also a couple of other effects on the timing and the level of gene expression, which I'm not going to show you. But most strikingly, what you notice is a decrease, a predicted decrease in the precision of the NKX22 OLIG2 boundary. So reducing, mimicking these mutants by reducing these parameters recovers all of the features we're seeing from the experimental data. So why is the precision of this boundary decreased? So it's not a consequence of increase in the overall noise. In the simulations, we can measure the noise, and there's no increase in the amplitude of the noise. Instead, what the simulations predict, so these are guest simulations looking at the predicted levels of OLIG2 and PAC6. In the wild type, we see some predicted relationship between OLIG2 and PAC6. In the enhancer mutant, what you notice is, or what's predicted, is that on average, the levels of OLIG2 should slightly decrease and the levels of PAC6 slightly increase. And we can ask now experimentally, if we go back into wild type and mutant embryos and compare PAC6 and OLIG2 levels, whether we see a similar phenomenon. And indeed we do. So if we compare experimentally measured levels of OLIG2 and PAC6 in wild type and enhancer mutant, what you see is you can recover some cells which appear to have surprisingly low levels of OLIG2 and high levels of PAC6, consistent with predictions from the simulations. So why does this lead to a reduction in the precision of the boundary? So if we come back to think about this structure of fluctuations around the OLIG2 steady state, the effect of slightly decreasing OLIG2 levels, increasing PAC6 levels, is to reorientate the structure of the fluctuations slightly more towards that saddle point, that transition point within there. So again, you're changing the structure of the noise, the structure of the fluctuations around the steady state, making it more likely that a noise-driven transition will occur.
Sorry, I didn't get this particular point here.
So
how do you go from what you just said before to
Right. And so the effect of that, if we look at so we think this is the OLIG2, this is the PAC6. Mm-hmm. So if we go to slightly lower levels of OLIG2, slightly higher levels of PAC6, we're moving the structure of these fluctuations. The fluctuations are more directed towards the saddle point. So it's not as dramatic as the PAC6 mutant because you still have the PAC6 dimension.
The saddle point is a red dot?
Yeah, it's a red dot there, sorry. Okay, so that's what I wanted to conclude, is that the network is also providing some precision to gene expression within the neural tube, and it's a consequence of structuring the fluctuations, the effect of stochasticity in gene expression in the context of a multi-stable system. Okay, so I could end now, or I could continue blathering on.
Well, what would you tell us if you
So, okay, shut me up in 10 minutes then. Is that okay with everyone?
At this point, would it be a caricature to say that you told us that, in a sense, the role of the morphogen here is to provide some kind of transient input?
Yes.
Which then you could forget about.
Right.
and the properties of the network and growth will sort of deploy that in space and time in a way that defines, that give rise to the pattern.
That's exactly what I would argue. So, you know, if you want to say this provocatively, I'd argue that the gene regulatory network is a morphogen, and all Hedgehog is doing is giving you some initial asymmetry to
You need some other activator in the system somewhere.
Yeah. So, and there are several molecular possibilities there, SOX2 being the one we always think about. And that's in the neural tube, that's expressed spatially and temporally uniform. So how we model that is we have a spatially and temporally uniform activator input onto all of those components. And in fact, yeah, and those are affected by the enhancer elements. Yeah.
So in light of the temporal properties of this network, how does it, I mean, it seems to me that it's quite related to the neuroblast model of temporal sequence of transcription factor activation, which in a way is a temporal version of the spatial gap gene pattern. You know, so I'm referring to the fact that, you know, spatially gap genes are mutually repressive,
yes,
and they have these spatial patterns, and the neuroblast, pretty much the same gene, will
be right. So you can think about it as this axis.
Exactly. Yeah. So this space-time coupling is a little bit what you also presented to us.
Yeah.
Using this as a morphogen that is an input, not much doing the pattern.
I agree. And that behavior is generated principally by these bistable switches. So if you have a particular initial condition and a topology of bistable switches, it allows you to sequence through those.
So in other words, if that is correct, using an in vitro system and providing a transient input in terms of, you know, Hedgehog, would you predict, or have you observed, that you would go through the whole sequence of expression of the different
And we can show that in vitro.
In a way that it's very similar to what neuroblasts would do?
I don't think you need to say it's similar to neuroblasts, but what we can see in vitro is a sequence of gene expression. And we can also demonstrate that genetically in vivo using, so indelible recombination, right? So Cre recombinase, if we look at cells which have ever expressed OLIG2, those include the current ones expressing OLIG2, but also cells which now express NKX22. So the cells which express NKX22 in have previously expressed OLIG2, so we can see that sequence of events.
There are no local interactions between cells in this model. Is that not
precisely
the role in setting boundaries?
Right, and I would argue that this type of result argues against this, right? So we're seeing a decrease in precision without a qualitative change in gene expression. So if there was differential adhesion in the red and green domains, you would expect these still to be able to sort out. Now, of course, you know, differential adhesion could play a role here. I'm just arguing it's not the dominant factor
also determining. Signaling between stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, of course, there could. Any model could be more complicated. Yeah, we can explain these behaviors without invoking more levels of complication.
If you go back to the last slide, I mean, can't you just argue without having the network that we know from the previous thing you showed us that every cell sees this transient increase in Hedgehog and then it disappears. So every cell is in a kind of dynamical system after the Hedgehog is gone. It's exactly the same. So it's just that the level of the transient Hedgehog dumps you into a particular attractor of that kind of dynamic.
Right, and then the bistability keeps you there. Yeah.
Well, not bistability, the fact you've turned off any new signal.
Yes.
So you're just sitting in the attractor that you landed in.
I agree.
But then when you come to your question about, you know, the delicacy of the boundaries, I mean, you've messed the system up. And so this transient thing that dumps you into the right attractor now dumps you into the wrong one quite often.
Yes.
But you don't really seem to me, in that one, you could easily make that work, and it doesn't require noise. It doesn't require an increase in noise or the structure of the noise.
Well, if you say you're being dumped into the wrong attractor, there must be some, what's the reason for being dumped into the wrong attractor? And I guess we're coming from the perspective of experimentalists observing this loss of precision when we delete an enhancer. So how do we explain that?
Well, the other thing that worries me is that at the moment the boundaries are coming from the bistability where you've got hysteresis. You know, because like as you showed us, you've got the upper branch and the lower branch and they overlap. So that's problematic, isn't it? Because that would always give you a mixed boundary.
Right, and that's.
So you have data shows a very unmixed boundary.
So that's why I wanted to show you this, the Drosophila image, right? The Drosophila orientation. So these boundaries, you know, so they're this precise, right? So this is a wild type embryo. So they're not straight, these boundaries. These are not super sharp like you'd expect to see an adhesion mediated boundary. So it's.
But so it's not this the level. Sharpness you'd want, is it? It's the level of mixing. That's a different thing.
I think I'm using those interchangeably, right? So we can see, so if you look here where you can see these.
They're not the same though, because if I could draw a curve along there and below it everything's blue and above it everything's red, then there's no mixing, but the curve doesn't have to be a straight line.
Right, but it, yeah, so it's.
And the hysteresis is telling you about mixing.
I'm not sure I agree with that.
The line.
But I think you would want to know what cell dynamics is in this context, to know.
Right, which comes back to this question.
Cells divide, it's going to be pushed away.
Precisely. So, and I think that's the question Mindy asked. I think that's really interesting. So I've talked about one component of stochasticity in the gene regulatory network. There's also noise in the signal itself, which is the stuff I'm not going to talk about. And then, in addition, there's clonal growth going on here, right? So you can see that clonal growth gives you. Shapes. And I think understanding the relative contributions of each of those to this level of precision, I think, is an interesting question.
I guess it's implying that position influences how the distance between those two sulfates in your.
Yeah, so clearly, I mean, there's pattern here, right? They're not completely intermixed, there's clear pattern here. I'm just arguing that there's some, these are not sharp, deterministic. Well positioned boundaries.
You're arguing that why doesn't a blue cell further down within the blue area, why don't you see a bit of a speckle pattern? Because some of those cells stochastically switch.
Right, but that comes back to this of how noise driven transition in a multi stable system. So you have to be close to the bifurcation point in order for noise to generate that switch.
Addressing this question.
I think it's. The issue of clonal growth and variability associated with it is a very big elephant. Right? Because just looking at this picture, right, there's a lot of variability right there. And you can ask whether this variability in color that we see is that,
right.
Or is it actually less than that?
Exactly.
Because there's a lot of variability in this whole thing. And then the big question is, do we need some other spatial interactions
I agree.
Above and beyond the input of Sonic Hedgehog at the very beginning of the start.
I agree. But also, if you think about the sources of variability, there's a trade-off, right? So from a graded morphogen perspective, you want to read out that gradient at the earliest time point possible because the tissue is small, the gradient is steepest. But then you're going to be degraded by growth. So from a growth perspective, you want to read as late as possible, but then your gradient is shallow and you've got less information. So understanding the trade-offs between those two constraints, I think, is what we're trying to do at the moment.
But in particular, it's striking that the raggedness of the clonal boundary, at least towards the ventral side, is about the same as the raggedness of the clone, the green clones.
Yeah.
You know, they're as ragged at the boundaries as would be the red, blue, or red, black boundary, which suggests that cell division, which most likely is coupled to cell intercalation, could be a source of, cell separation by itself.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. That's great.
Because in not all tissues, cell division causing cell intercalation.
Yeah. I agree. But then you still have to. So if you're arguing it's only about cell growth, then you still have to explain why you see less precision when you just delete an enhancer from one gene. So it's clear that it's I completely agree with you. I think growth is going to be important in understanding sharpness of boundaries, precision of boundaries. But there are other things that clearly contribute that when we look experimentally.
Well, I'm not saying that it has to be the case, but you could very well imagine how downstream properties of these transcripts and factors actually control you know, the modalities of cell division in such a way that intercalations could be enhanced or whatever.
Yeah, I guess.
It doesn't have to be the case. It's not impossible.
Yeah. All right, let me show my acknowledgements to you. So thank you all very much.
So, well, what are you going to tell us that you didn't tell us?
I'm afraid we don't have time for it, but just so we would know.
So what I wanted to talk about is, so I focused entirely on hedgehog signaling, the very ventral neural tube. I wanted to tell you about the opposing gradient, so BMP coming from the opposite pole of the neural tube, and how the combination of those anti-parallel gradients are interpreted via the gene regulatory network to give you embryo-to-embryo consistency in the position of boundaries.
But there are also, if you sort of start going from the other end, there are seven other territories or something.
Exactly. But the principle of this, so they're defined by transcription factors which cross-repress one another, and that with two opposing inputs through a gene regulatory network of cross-repression gives you the similar behavior to what I've shown you here, is that you can establish positions and then maintain them via bi-stability. And in addition, the combination of those two inputs gives you more accurate positioning in the center of the neural tube where both of those gradients are relatively low.